interview with Fred Chaney, Leader of the Opposition in the Senate, Parliament House, Canberra, the 5th of May 1989. The first area I'd like to talk to you about is just your general view of the Parliament-Executive relationship as it is.
Well, I think it's not quite in the balance that I would like to see. I think the Parliament is undervalued and underutilised as an institution. That's been my consistent view for a long time. I mean, even in government, I originally promoted the idea of the Scrutiny of Bills Committee, for example. That was sent to a committee of which I was a member. It's an interesting story, actually. I was then made a minister. The committee reported in favour of my idea. The government rejected it. I had to go on behalf of the government and say why we rejected it. And the Senate implemented it anyway, which I was delighted about. And indeed, I was the first minister to accept amendments. Now, I only tell you that story because it reflects a long-term attitude that I think the Parliament needs to be used more fully to improve the legislative process, principally, but also the scrutiny role. Now, I think you would say of every Australian Parliament, including the Federal Parliament, and the least including the Senate, that they are overly dominated by the executive, that the legislative and review function is put under far too much pressure. I mean, I don't think the Reps is a legislative chamber at all, virtually.
Rubber stamp?
It really does not perform a legislative function. I mean, complex legislation is put through in a matter of hours or minutes, or things that we spend weeks on here are dealt with in an hour or a day, you know. I mean, it's... And you'll often... I mean, the proof of it is that after proper scrutiny, there is usually bipartisan agreement on the need for change. So, I mean, that's proof positive that the thing doesn't get an examination on the substance, generally, in the lower house.
A lot of textbooks talk about parliamentary government. Would a more accurate...
You can't have parliamentary government.
Would a more accurate description be party government? I mean, after the election...
Yes, I think that in the most of the Australian parliaments, the combination of party discipline, you know, the strong caucus system and party discipline system that applies, means that the governments have really pushed back the scrutiny and legislative function. Now, that's not universally so. I mean, in fact, traditionally there have been some very valuable committee activities in the House of Representatives. I pick merely as an example, there's been a standing committee on Aboriginal affairs long before the recent reorganisation, which I think has consistently made a very substantial contribution to that area of policy. I mean, there are things on Aboriginal health environment and so on. I mean, there would be a decade of excellent work.
That's pretty well an exception, though, isn't it? I mean, the vast area of the executive cover. House of Reps, there's very little of that.
Now, the institution of a Senate-style committee system in the Reps may well produce, you know, a whole new wave of parliamentary work, which will be very valuable. I think some of the committees are doing work, but as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on it, I'm not close to in touch with it, as I understand it, references to those committees solely come from the government.
Do you think the Senate would operate less effectively as a scrutiny body if it the government controlled?
Well, I suppose the honest answer to that is yes. But I think that if you look at the period in the Senate when we had control of it, under the phrase of government, you would have to conclude that it continued to exercise a considerable scrutiny and legislative function. Certainly way, way in advance of that of the House of Representatives. Now, the reason for that is that any government knows that under the current electoral arrangements, any majority is temporary. And the traditions which have been established, the procedures which have been established, are not going to be ditched for a short term. So that during the period of Fraser government hegemony, if you like, in the Senate, I think you'd have to say the committee system remained vibrant, the Senate was still not a rubber stamp.
Has the Parliament, you take the House of Reps and the Senate, has the Parliament got enough resources, enough manpower, enough time, that they sit long enough to adequately cover that vast range of things the executive does?
I mean, the answer to that is no, but the problem with that answer is that there would never be enough time. I mean, you've got an elected element of government of a few hundred, as against hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats who are beavering away, and the resources are out of balance. But the counter to that is that the parliament can strike unexpectedly, and I mean, it is there. It has. I mean, if you take, say, the scrutiny of the budget, I mean, for years the Estimates Committee struggled to get adequate information. The problem now is not adequate information, but whether you can process the amount we've produced. I mean, that job's been achieved, if you like. And you can go on multiplying the effect. The Scrutiny of Bills Committee, which has the assistance of counsel, its very existence influences the way legislation is drafted. Because people now know that if they're drafted a certain way, it will be drawn to the attention of the Parliament and is likely to be attended to.
A lot of people talking about the Senate committees have said they acknowledge, you know, the good work that's done. They argue things like the Estimates Committees, it's very patchy. And also, as a lot of senators are overstretched. There's only 50 committees.
It has to be patchy. I mean, it's of the nature of it. But the positive way of looking at that is to say that you're never quite sure where lightning's going to strike. I mean, I don't think that the Aboriginal Affairs Department was expecting what it got in the Estimates Committee last year.
Is there a danger of political grandstanding by senators, say, to...
It's a political chamber, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, as against that, I mean, you must... I mean, to stay on that example, because it's a recent high-profile example of parliamentary activity, both committee and standing committee estimate... Or select committee, wasn't it? Select committee and Estimates Committees. If you examine the record of the Parliament, you'll find a lot of speeches, not a lot, but certainly speeches being made consistently over the last 5 years, 6 years, to no effect. You can be, say, there's been political grandstanding. The truth is that the only thing that has evoked a government response has been something which has had a political impact. So, I mean, I think that is just a pejorative way of describing the democratic process, and I think it's bullshit. I really do.
Well, second year,
just cost myself a dollar. I promise to put in a dollar every time, I swear.
All right.
Okay. Keep the note.
The second year I'd like to ask you about is just your general views on the new building, just overall.
I think it's terrific.
And then whether or not you think the new building will affect the Parliament executive relationship. There's been speculation that it might.
Well, yes, I think I'm on the record on this. I think the building, I mean, it obviously has... No building is perfect, but from an institutional point of view, I think there are two major complaints I'd make about the operation of this Parliament. First is that it is excessively dominated by the executive. The second is that it is excessively, that the fourth estate are major players as against observers. The old building, I think, lent itself to both of those, buttressed both of those deficiencies. I think the new building, the geography of the new building, gives the Parliament a chance in a number of respects. First, the executive is segregated. I happen to think that's a very good thing. Second, I think that the upgrading of facilities, the availability of much better committee rooms, and the whole upgrading of the building itself should contribute to a more self-conscious Parliament in a positive sense, a Parliament which is more conscious of its own value and importance. And until people take their parliamentary role seriously, nothing will happen. So I personally think there are real pluses in the separation of the executive, the improvement of the general parliamentary facilities, and the separation of the greater degree of separation from the fourth estate. Now, I think the institutional impact of those should be positive.
A lot of people have talked about because of the sheer size, the informal contact which characterised the old building. Here, that informal contact's not happening as much. People aren't bumping into each other as much. They're eating in their rooms more because it's now a civilised space. And they're missing a lot of that informal contact. A lot of people place great stress on that. Others have said, well, it doesn't really matter. What's your view on
that? My view is that that is overstated. I think that the chumminess and incestuousness of politics is actually a disadvantage. I think it needs a little more space. So my view is that... I accept that it might be wrong, that maybe the function of this building in the end is to simply, by a process of osmosis, to integrate the conflicting strands in society into conflicting views and to emerge with some sort of workable consensus, and that the sort of cheek-by-jowl thing is therefore very significant. my own view is a colder one, perhaps, that a little more space and more time to think wouldn't hurt.
One of your front bench colleagues said to me the other day that he thought because of that less personal contact between people, he thought that may lead to more animosity, more misunderstandings, particularly in party room discussions.
It may.
But overall, you're happy with the building?
I'm hopeful, yeah.
Well, just the last area then.
I think it's a mistake, incidentally, to think of it as a building. It's more a settlement. It's a little, it's a village, a town. And I mean, the fact is that any design of this building, of the any proposed design of a Parliament House, which put it all in one building, produced a monstrosity. And what they've done here is build a walled town.
Well, last area, just briefly, is the big area of parliamentary reform. What sorts of things do you think could be done? What's achievable in terms of giving the Parliament a better scrutiny role of the executive?
I think one of the most important things that is needed is an acceptance by a government party that there is value in doing that. I mean, there are various routes to this. There is the self-assertive route, which was, say, represented in the establishment of the Scrutiny of Bills Committee, where a backbencher, who, I mean, I picked that example because it's one I know, and I haven't really put up the idea. The Parliament itself processed the idea. The Parliament came out, the committee said, we like the idea. The government of the day said, no. Parliament said, well, we're going to do it anyway. Now, that's an assertive approach. I think that there is room for positive government acceptance of the value of the legislative process as against the bureaucratic process for preparing legislation. And, I mean, you could say that Robert Ray's acceptance of the need for some committee inquiry and look at that as an attempt to improve it. A cynic might say it's just an attempt to find out ways of facilitating the sausage machine. But I mean, it would be certainly my personal intention in government to not be resistant to parliamentary involvement, rather the reverse.
Would you like to see the committee system expand, or do you think it's stretched?
No, I think you, one of the real traps that the pro-parliament, I would say that, if I don't mean, this is a personal truth, but I think Michael Macklin represents a quite, and the Democrats often represent a quite unrealistic approach to Parliament. They keep loading on functions, ignoring the fact that every time you load on a function, you diminish the amount of senatorial or reps' time that can be put. You're really bureaucratising the Parliament if you keep multiplying functions. So I think the thing has to be defined. If anything, we have too many committees, not too few, and you cannot, you know, expand the amount of human time available very much, and therefore you've got to look, I think, to have very streamlined functions, and in terms of the scrutiny function, maintain the element of surprise.
Is there enough staff resources, backup research facilities and so on?
I think there is already staff and research resources which produce material which is beyond the capacity of senators and members to absorb.
Just one last one. Party discipline is always held up as a key reason why the executive does dominate. A lot of Labor backbenchers I've spoken to said they privately would like to see less discipline, but immediately recognise the problems with the media's attitude and so on. Do you think party discipline could or should be less?
I think I personally would prefer a sort of graded system of discipline, the 1-2-3 line whip tie. I don't even know how that works exactly, but the idea of a graded degree of discipline, I think, would be
it's
good.
It's the third line whip tie, I think.
Yeah, and I would be very happy to see, as I say, greater reliance on the elective element of government, which I regard the Parliament as being, than on the bureaucratic element, giving the elective element a greater testing process. That involves greater freedom. That's why I put some stress earlier on the fact that I think part of the changes I would look for need to come from a sympathetic government. It's very easy for an opposition to be keen on that. It's harder for a government to. You've also got to fly in the face of a quite honourable, long Labor Party tradition. There's nothing intellectually wrong with the idea of a caucus. I mean, I hope to disagree with it, but it's a rational way to structure a political party. And you've really got to overcome that very deep tradition.
If you're a leader of, say, the next government or a government, how much difficulty do you think you'd have in persuading your own party and your own ministers?
You'd have more trouble with your ministers than your party. See, ministers are very affected by the bureaucrats. The real blockage would be the bureaucrats advising the ministers. But again, if I can go back to my experience, particularly in Aboriginal affairs, where I thought we were often grappling with very difficult problems, and I had very fine public servants, I was very happy with them at the level of, very happy with them generally. We would labour long and hard to bring forward a legislative proposal and put our very best efforts into it, and then it would go through the screen of the cabinet. In every case, I was subjected to very critical backbench scrutiny under Phil Ruddock's chairmanship. Everything I ever brought forward was improved beyond our own efforts. We found they had ideas, thoughts, and picked up things we didn't. Now, as a minister, I thought it was terrific. And that's sub-parliamentary, if you like, but it's really part of the parliamentary process. And again, if you look at the approach that, say, I adopted on the ADC, I mean, there was the introduction of legislation, lengthy period of consultation, major amendment. I mean, that's the way I see the Parliament working most effectively.
A lot of ministers would see that as frustration.
Yes, that's right.
Some of mine does.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, every bill which is ever subjected to proper parliamentary scrutiny winds up being changed by mutual agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lesson in that. There should be a lesson in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for your time.
Okay, pleasure.
That's great.